Well, we're going to struggle and try to get through this rainstorm on our tin roof, and hopefully we can all hear what we're saying. But at any rate, we're continuing on with our exploration of our theme for the new year, which is, of course, ready, right? Last week we saw how Jesus told his followers that they need to always be ready for his return because it could come at any time. Come at a time we don't expect. Remember, he said this. So always be ready because you don't know the day your Lord will come. So you also must be ready because the Son of Man will come at a time you don't expect him. And then we also talked about how being ready for his return, we talked about needing to be ready in the sense of longing for, being anxious for, and even praying for him to return soon. Y'all remember that? I want to spend the next couple of Sundays after today exploring a little bit more about what Jesus meant by being ready here. Because, interestingly, Jesus didn't just leave his listeners hanging there wondering what he was talking about when he said, be ready. He went right on to explain a little bit about that. We'll talk about that over the next couple of weeks. But for today, I'd like for us to get a little context for what he's saying here in these verses here. Because these verses about being ready are actually part of a larger portion of scriptures, part of what is known as the Olivet Discourse, teachings that Jesus presented to his disciples, the 12, ones we call the 12 apostles, during the last week of his life. And it's called the Olivet Discourse because it took place on the Mount of Olives, overlooking Jerusalem. And we're not going to try to answer all of the questions and the controversies that kind of swirl around those verses in Matthew 24 and 25 that comprise the Olivet Discourse. Because people have disagreed, people have argued, and they've thought about what he was saying there, about which of his statements refer to prophetic announcements about the last days of earth, which of them referred to things that may have already happened, which of his things are literal, which of the things he said are figurative. There's lots of debate there, none of which is important to what we're going to be talking about today and for the next few weeks, thankfully. But all of this talk with his disciples began with a brief conversation as they were leaving the great temple there in Jerusalem. And it actually is another example of how tone deaf the 12 disciples always seem to be. They pretty much never missed an opportunity to fail to grasp the obvious, which I find to be pretty endearing to me, because they're so much like me. They're so much like me in this sense, in this instance. I'm right there with them most of the time. How easy it is for me to walk obliviously right by a moment that has deep significance. Deep significance in a spiritual sense, or maybe just in a sense of what makes us all humans. It brings us together as beings created in the image of God. And I walk right by it and say something like, hey, nice weather we're having today. Or how about that rain we're having today? Or how about those saints? Whatever. You ever find yourself doing stuff like that? Or maybe for the disciples here, and maybe for me sometimes, it's not so much that we're blinded to the fact that something heavy is going on, something deep and momentous is happening. No, we see it, we sense it, we know it, but we just don't know how to respond to it. We don't know what we should say in the face of this tragedy or this grief or this trauma or whatever it might be. So we say something. We say something in a genuine but misguided attempt to help. Anybody else ever been there with me and doing something like that? I'm reminded of, and I didn't get a clip to include here, but I'm reminded of that scene from Titanic. Remember that movie? And the unsinkable Molly Brown is sitting in a lifeboat, and the Titanic is going down. And you remember what she said? She said, "Well, there's something you don't see every day." I mean, seriously? But that's the kind of thing I do a lot, don't you? Well, maybe not you, but people like me do that a lot. Anyway, at least some of the 12 apostles, or maybe one of them, was kind of like that. About what? Well, go back one more chapter and take a look at Matthew 23. Don't do it right now, but you probably have seen it before. But take a look at Matthew 23, and you'll see in most of your Bibles, there's a heading there at the beginning of the chapter that says seven woes, or something like that. And when you read it, what you'll see throughout that whole chapter is Jesus is basically pronouncing judgment on the teachers of the law and on the Pharisees for their monumental hypocrisy. And it is an amazing display that goes on and on and on. And here's one of the problems we have with just having a Bible to read and not having a movie to watch of what happened when Jesus lived on this earth. Because when we read it, it's kind of hard to tell whether he's professing profound anger at that moment or whether he's expressing profound sorrow. Probably a combination of both. Whichever way you read it, there's no denying that the entire chapter is a display of Jesus' deep emotion. Don't ever let anybody tell you that your religion is simply a matter of logic and reason. If your emotions are not engaged as you follow Jesus, you're not fully giving yourself to Him. Well, anyway, this emotional event of Jesus' pronouncing judgment finally ends at the end of chapter 23, and I didn't get a slide of it, but let me read it for you. Starting in verse 37. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem," he said, "you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" It's deep emotion. And the apostles, not really knowing what to say in this moment, they do this. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him and said, call his attention to the buildings. And Matthew didn't really get specific here. Let me read it to you from the Gospel of Mark. He goes into a little bit more detail. As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." right after Jesus has had this incredibly emotional moment, somebody comes up to him and says that. Now, most biblical scholars think that Mark got a lot of the information that he used to write his book from Peter, which means that it is very likely that Peter is the one who came up to Jesus and said, "Hey, look, look at these giant stones." And doesn't that sound like something Peter would say? At a moment like this, where his master, where his friend has just expressed deep emotion, he's just experienced this highly emotional encounter. Peter doesn't really know what to do. He doesn't know what to say, but he thinks, "I got to say something to lighten the mood. I got to do something here." And so he says this. And you've been there too. So have I. We all have. Well, Jesus' reply to this is shocking. And perhaps it shows he's still in an emotional state. Look what Jesus said to this. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." And that was an amazingly shocking thing for those apostles to hear Jesus say. Shocking because the temple represented the presence of God right there among his people. How could something like this happen? And wasn't the presence of Jesus even more evidence that God was on their side? That things were just going to keep getting better and better. And that they, the apostles, were going to have an inside track to all the good jobs, the good leadership roles that were going to take place when Jesus sets up his kingdom. Can you imagine the faces of these apostles as Jesus said this? And their jaws must have hung open like that. Their eyes must have glazed over. They must have stared at Jesus in stunned silence. They must have looked at each other with questions like, "Did he just say what I thought I heard him say? Did you hear him say what? Are we hearing him right? Did he really just say that? How could this be?" This temple that they were looking at with these massive stones and the beautiful architecture, it had been rebuilt after Solomon's original temple had been destroyed, which, by the way, should have been a clue to them that, hey, maybe something like this could happen again. But this temple that they were looking at had been rebuilt 500 years before. 500 years before this moment. And within the last 100 or 50 or so years, the King Herod had done a massive rebuilding and restoring and restoration and remodeling of the temple. And it was amazing what they were looking at. But it had been standing there for over 500 years. Can we even imagine such a thing? There's nothing like that in this country right now. There is nothing like it. The Capitol building in Washington, that's only been there a couple of hundred years. Now, maybe you people who travel to Europe have seen stuff like this that is that old. But there's nothing like this in America. Nothing like it. Something has been standing for 500 years, in constant use, by the way. You kind of get the feeling that it's going to be there forever. And so this announcement, this prophecy from Jesus is shocking to them. Jesus' temple represented who they were religiously. The chosen people of God. And it was so shocking that they couldn't even respond to this. They didn't know what to say. The next verse tells us how they eventually did respond. Later. You see, later. After they'd had some time to sit with this for a while, with this crazy idea that Jesus had come up with, after they've gone over it in their heads for a while, after they've now gotten to a place where they can sit down with him privately in a quiet place and ask him some questions where they won't be interrupted, they said, the disciples came to him privately and said, "Tell us, when will all this happen? What sign will signal your return at the end and the end of the world?" And Jesus' responses to this constitute the great and the controversial Olivet Discourse. And it fills up the rest of chapter 24 and chapter 25. Now, if a good lawyer had been present at this moment, and too bad there wasn't one there. Amen? But if a good lawyer had been present at this moment, by the way, why didn't Jesus pick a lawyer to be part of the 12? I mean, he didn't come up with a lawyer until Paul came along later, right? He didn't pick a lawyer. I've always often wondered about that. But if a lawyer had been there and had been listening in, we might have been spared all the controversy and all the dilemmas about the Olivet Discourse. Because a good lawyer would have jumped up at this moment and said, "Objection. Compound question." And the judge would have said, "Sustained. Rephrase your question. Ask one question at a time. There's three questions going on here. Three questions. You don't get to ask compound questions in a trial because then you don't know what question the witness is responding to. Amen? You only get one question, one answer. Okay? That's how it works. Well, and that is the heart of the controversy surrounding the Olivet Discourse. It's very difficult to know what parts of Jesus' response are directed to what, which of these three questions. It's hard to tell. And then you've got Jesus, who just in the regular course of his ministry would often say things that didn't really respond specifically to a question he'd been asked. Or sometimes his responses would come in the form of a parable or a story. Think about his conversation with Nicodemus back in John chapter 3. That conversation left Nicodemus, who was a brilliant teacher in Israel, scratching his head and wondering, "What was it I just heard from this man?" Think about Jesus' trial and conversation with Pontius Pilate just a few days after this, which left Pilate saying, "I don't even know what's truth anymore." Maybe some of that was going on, that kind of thing was going on as Jesus talked to his disciples there on the Mount of Olives, overlooking Jerusalem, overlooking the great temple, which he said was about to be completely destroyed. Well, Jesus tells his disciples all kinds of terrible things that are going to happen, including this. "Then you will be arrested, persecuted, and killed. You will be hated all over the world because you are my followers." Not sure. These 12 guys had heard stuff like this before from Jesus. he'd heard it before, but suddenly, now, in the face of everything else that he was saying, in the face of his statement about the temple which was going to be destroyed, the temple that they had felt was so solid and permanent and trustworthy. Well, now this statement must have hit them like a slap in the face, like a punch in the gut. Now this whole Jesus thing was suddenly getting real. Suddenly getting real in ways that they hadn't really considered much before. And he wasn't finished yet. Then he completely blows their minds when he says this: "Truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." Now, without getting into a lot of the controversies and debates from the Olivet Discourse, let me simply say this. This phrase, "this generation," you see that there? Which, by the way, is a good and accurate translation from the Greek word that was used in the original text. But it's a phrase that's not actually very specific. And it's subject to a number of interpretations. However, here's what we know from history. Okay? Here's what we know from history. Every one of the 11 apostles who were sitting there listening to Jesus talk, within 60 or 70 years from this moment, had suffered persecution, and most of them had been executed for their belief in Jesus. Only John died a death that wasn't a martyr's death. And that all happened within 60 or 70 years from this moment. History also tells us that within 40 years, maybe less, from the day that Jesus said this, the temple was destroyed. The stones were thrown down, just like he said they would be. And some of those stones are still there to this day. There they are. Silent reminders of the truth of Jesus' words. And it's right after Jesus tells them that this generation is going to see it all happen that he tells them this: "So always be ready. Always be ready." Okay. So that was a nice little history lesson, Ambrose. Thank you. Thanks a lot. But other than that, what does any of this have to do with us? What does any of this have to do with our theme of being ready? Well, here it is. And it's just a very small point today, just one little point today, easy to remember. And here it is. Sometimes, the things we need to be ready for are going to be different than the things we expected. Want me to say it again? Sometimes the things we need to be ready for are going to be different than the things we expected to be ready for. Andy talked about that a little bit today in our Sunday morning class, which is on the Sermon on the Mount. And by the way, if you're not coming to Sunday morning class, you are missing something that is amazing. You are missing something. You need to be here for this. But he talked about it, the life of the unexpected. And I'm thinking, wow, Andy, did you read my notes or something? Probably. Or maybe the Spirit was working. Probably. Sometimes what we need to be ready for are things that we didn't really expect to be ready for. When the apostles or Peter said, "Hey, Jesus, check out these big old rocks here. Check out this amazing architecture." he kind of expected Jesus to say, yes, and here shall this temple stand till the end of time, and you shall serve as my leaders in this great new organization that I'm building. That's what they expected. That's not what he said. That's not what he told them to be ready for. Instead, he turned their expectations completely upside down. And we need to be ready for things to be different than what we expected them to be. Are we ready? Are we actually ready to face actual hatred and persecution because we believe in Jesus? We probably don't really expect that to happen. Not here. Not in America. Not in the land of the First Amendment, which reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The First Amendment. Listen, it could happen. It could happen here, as it is happening to our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. This nation is changing rapidly. It's not the same place it was when these words were written down. On some level, in some places in our nation, it's already happening. Are we ready? And you're probably thinking, gee, Ambrose, why'd you have to go there? Why'd you have to go straight to worst case scenario? Why'd you have to go straight to DEFCON 1? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because Jesus said, you will be persecuted. You will be hated because of me. Maybe it's because, as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, it's going to be a blessing for you when you are persecuted, when it happens. It's going to be a blessing for you. Be glad when it happens. You want to be blessed, don't you? Don't see too many of you saying yeah on this one, but you want to be blessed, don't you? You want to be ready to receive blessing, don't you? Well, how about this? Jesus told his disciples to be ready because the single most solid and unshakable foundation of who they were as the chosen people of God, the temple, was about to come crashing down. So be ready. I just wonder, what understandings we are clinging to as part of our identity as his church. I wonder if he's telling us we need to be ready to walk away from some of that in order to better represent and to better show his gospel of grace. I wonder what ideas he wants us to be ready to walk away from so that we will stop falling into the sin of walking away from our brothers and sisters who think differently than we do on certain. Heard me right, from the sin of walking away. Maybe he's telling us to be ready to love people sacrificially, even when we're misunderstood, even when we're misinterpreted, even when we're unappreciated. Maybe he's telling us to be ready to do things for the kingdom that we never thought we would do. We never thought we could do. That we never thought we would have to do. Maybe he's telling us to be ready to do those things, not because we've got to do them, but because we want to do them, to serve in his kingdom. So what's he telling you? What's he telling me? And what's he telling us as his church to be ready for that we never expected would be a part of our walk with Jesus? Are we ready? Are we ready for anything? Let's stand and sing.